Okay, so very warm welcome to the evening. My name is Pamela Bandu. I'm going to be chairing the evening. So just to give you a bit of sense of what we're going to be doing. So we're going to start with Vishwapani talking for a little bit. And then we'll have Dorothy talking for a little bit. And then they're going to talk to each other. And after that, we'll invite questions from the floor. So I'm just going to say just a couple of words just to introduce Vishwapani first of all. So Vishwapani is an ordained member of the Trirana Buddhist Order. He's president of the North London Buddhist Centre. And some of you may have heard him on the radio. He's sometimes speaks on Thought for the Day. And he's just written a book about the Buddha, Gautama and Buddha, which I can thoroughly recommend. It's very readable. It's a very stimulating account of the Buddha. It's very nice. It draws on recent scholarship, so it's very up to date from that point of view. But at the same time, it very much gets to the heart of who Gautama Buddha was and the significance of the Buddha. So I can very much recommend the book. I've known Vishwapani for many, many years, and he's always a stimulating company. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing Vishwapani.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian. Well, welcome. It's good to see so many people here. And can everyone see? Or do we need to adjust? Maybe. Just feel free to move around so people can see. Well, I'm very pleased to be here doing this now for a number of reasons. But one reason is it's sort of a book launch for me, and I've done other book launches, but after all that effort of writing, it's very gratifying to have something to hold in your hand and say, here's my book. And also to be doing something with Dorothy. We've corresponded over the years, for a few years. She wrote something on her blog about my Thought for the Day broadcast. And I have, on my computer, I set up a Google alert. So if someone writes something about Vishwapani, then I get an email message, so I know about it. If your name is John Smith, this probably doesn't work. But Vishwapani is quite easy to keep track of the Google alerts. And the talk that I gave was about, that particular talk, was about how can religions be part of the solution to the world's problems rather than part of the problem itself, which very often seems to be the case when you open a newspaper. And what I talked about, as I recall, was the role of belief and views in determining our actions, and saying that up to a point at least, the issue isn't so much what we believe, whether we believe in God or not. The issue is more how we believe, whether we hold on to those views as articles of faith and matters of dogma, or if we see them as helpful ways in which we come to understand the world and our lives. So that was the starting point for a dialogue. And when I read Dorothy's her last book, which was called, what's it called?
Why Do We Believe?
Why We Lie?
No, the one before that.
What Should I Believe?
What Should I Believe? That's the one. What Should I Believe? I could see why she'd been interested in what I was saying, because that was very much the theme. What people do believe, why they believe it, and the effects of those beliefs. And with her latest book, Why We Lie, again, I could see some affinities. So we'll be exploring that in the course of the evening. And I'm also very pleased because I think to a certain extent, this evening is an example or part of a dialogue between the Buddhist traditions which have come to the West and people have been practicing now for many years, and the whole field of psychology. The title for our evening is Buddhism, Science and Reality. And I won't be talking very much about science. I'm going to leave that to Dorothy. I did an English degree, and the last time I did science was physics O level, which is a very long time ago. So, but we'll see how we go with that. I think the theme we're going to be exploring under this title, Buddhism, Science and Reality, is the most important part of that is reality. What is reality? How can we know what reality is? How can we approach it? How can we know what's true? And the subtitle is, how can we understand ourselves? Because ourselves, one's mind, one's experience, is really the reality that we are engaged with. Science, I suppose, operates through experiment and observation. And Buddhism has a somewhat different approach to seeing reality, but that is a core concern for Buddhists of all sorts. Buddhist approach is mostly a matter of reflection, of looking at the mind, and of understanding the ways in which our minds filter, structure, interpret, distort, bring our interpretations, bring our biases to what we experience. So how do we distort? We'll be talking about that, but that question is very relevant to this topic. How can we understand ourselves better? So how to approach this? Now, I'm going to approach this through talking about the Buddha. And that's appropriate, I hope, in that I'm a Buddhist and I'm representing that side of the discussion. And also because that's the book that I've written. And the Buddha's life story is really the model that's always framed how Buddhists consider what they're doing in practicing Buddhism. So, in the biography that I've written, I've looked at the sources which we have, and actually we have quite a lot of sources with some claim to be historical, and tried to separate those out from the legends that have grown up around the Buddha, which are many. And that's not something that Buddhists in the East necessarily do. I've also tried to understand Buddhist society and to see why he was saying what he was saying in that context. Now, who is he talking to? And the texts that we have do have quite a lot of what seems to be fairly clearly legend mixed in with history. And also quite a lot of doctrine, which in some cases seems to be heavily worked over by later generations of monks, trying to make sense of it all. But sometimes, and this can only be quite a subjective way of approaching the Buddha, sometimes for me, you hear a voice, a very distinctive, very powerful voice of a human being. A human being who was strongly driven to understand himself and his reality. So I want to just read you a passage from one of those early texts, those early scriptures, which is the Buddha really talking about growing up in the particular part of ancient India where he was born. And he's talking to people who are about to get into some kind of conflict. He says, fear is born from arming oneself. That actually takes a little bit of thinking about, because usually we think that arming oneself is something one does because one is afraid. But he says, fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around, like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. So he's describing his experience through this metaphor here of the people in his society are crammed together. They're fighting for space as if they're fish in a river that's drying up. There's not enough water for them. And therefore we experience ourselves as being at odds with each other. And then he says, this world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. And I'll just add that, you know, the Buddhist tradition has often wanted to say that the Buddha himself, even before he got enlightened, was this very serene, calm figure who felt no strong emotions, which makes him rather hard to relate to. But in this particular text, he says, oh, no, no, no. I was completely distraught. That's what he says. So there's this powerful experience of disillusionment that starts the Buddha on his quest. Then I discerned a thorn, hard to see, here, lodged deep in the heart. And this is really the Buddha's key insight that let me just read the last bit. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. So reading Dorothy's book about lies, I was very taken by the way that she extends the meaning of a lie from me telling some kind of fib, some kind of simple untruth to another person, for whatever reasons of convenience that might suit me, to the lies that we tell ourselves, the lies that we come to believe in through belief systems, the lies that are the lies of our fantasies and so on. And what in that passage I just read from the Buddha, it's the experience of a young man becoming very disillusioned with a fundamental lie that he sees in his society. The lie is that I'm not responsible. He sees people in conflict, and what they fail to understand is that there's something motivating them which they're not aware of. His image for that is a thorn stuck in the chest, which people don't even know it's there. And he notices it. He sees a thorn and thinks, I've got to pull this out. But how? And the rest of the Buddha's biography is really about him trying to pull out that thorn. Then the Buddha goes off, according to the traditional life story, and studies meditation, has various mystical experiences. But these mystical experiences are claimed by the people who teach them to be the ultimate goal of all spiritual life and therefore of all life. But the Buddha sees that as a lie. And the lie really is that ultimately it's all right. Because if you can find your way into the right kind of experience, you'll find something that's free from all the things that we find difficult in the world. Actually, we'll find God if you have the right kind of experience. And the Buddha just doesn't believe it because he has that experience and he's still himself. He's still subject to the things that seem to be causing him unhappiness. So what's the lie? So the lie is, this is something I can hold to. This experience I have, this mystical experience, is something I can hold to. It's ultimate. But all experiences arise for certain reasons and they come to an end. So what the Buddha does then, which I think is really the heart of the example of the Buddha's life, he discards the various methods of religious practice that are there in his society. And he decides to do something which arguably nobody had done before in quite this way, which was simply to turn his attention. And this is attention which has been powered and developed through really learning to concentrate in meditation. concentrate very deeply, to turn that attention on the mind itself, on the process of perception, the way in which experience, what we call experience, is created. To look at that, to see how it is that his mind creates his reality, and to see therefore how his reality might be different, how he might change. What he discovers is what you could call three big lies. The three big lies that underlie the human condition. These three big lies are firstly that things are permanent. Secondly, things are substantial. And thirdly, things are satisfactory. So things are permanent means that I will last in some way. And experience shows that I won't last. Experience shows that everything changes. The body changes, just look in the mirror. And ultimately, the ultimate form of change for us as individuals is death. So the sense that there are things that last, endure in a permanent way, is at odds with this one universal human experience, death. And yet, the difficulty of coming to terms with our own deaths, our own mortality, that's really at the heart of how we come to... that's one of the key things that we have to learn to cope with in our lives. So the Buddha takes us a step further. He says, well, if everything we see is changing, if I am changing all the time, if my mind is changing all the time, then what actually is there of substance? So the second lie is that the world is substantial, I am substantial. And the Buddha says, no, it isn't. It's insubstantial. And the human condition is about coping with that. So the word that I'm picking up from Dorothy's book, lying, is what the Buddha talks about as delusion. And thirdly, we think that in some way we can find something that will make us ultimately happy, whether it's the right man or woman or possessions or whatever, but there's something we can have that will give us ultimate satisfaction. That's the third lie. And the truth is that life is always in some way unsatisfactory. So the mind, beneath that, Buddha has a lot to say about how the mind works. And as I said, this, in a way, this evening is a part of a much broader dialogue that's going on in many ways, in many levels, between Buddhists with their kind of introspective experience and evidence, I suppose, and the world of neuroscience and psychology. How does the mind work? How does the mind create our reality? And how does it create our suffering, which isn't actually the Buddha's overriding concern? How does the mind lead us to suffer? And he says, through observation, and generations of meditators can have found this as sound advice. He says that one lie is, comes from a basic human response of things that we like. I like it leads us to the lie, I can keep it, which he calls craving. And I don't like it, which is again another fundamental human response, leads to the lie, I can make it go away, which he calls aversion. And delusion is the failure to see what we're doing, that we're constantly wanting more of the things that we are attracted to, and wanting to push away the things that we find difficult. So this is, I'm talking rather abstractly, but this is the basic Buddhist analysis of how the mind works. Because we're driven by craving, aversion and delusion, we get ourselves into states of suffering. And there's a path, that's the other part, the thing that the Buddha discovered. That seeing that that's how our minds work, is important. But it's not enough. It's certainly not enough just to be told that. The path he taught starts with ethics, which really means bringing our actions into accordance with a truth. So if the lie is, my actions don't have consequences, then the truth, my actions do have consequences, always implies some kind of ethical sense, some kind of moral sense that takes account of the way in which we affect other people. And the second part of the path is the tradition of mental training, which, you know, goes by the name meditation. And really there are two aspects to meditation that I can draw out. One is mindfulness, which means learning to see. This whole thing is about seeing reality. Mindfulness is learning to pay attention to the reality of this moment, whether it's the physical reality of my body, the nature of my thoughts, the nature of my feelings. Reality in that sense, in a very simple sense of what am I experiencing right now. And then the other aspect of meditation is this attentional training, learning to pay attention more and more and more deeply. Well, there are other aspects as well, but that'll do. So the third dimension of the path of the Buddha taught is what he called wisdom, which is he often talked about as bringing together on the basis of ethics and meditation, just the process of reflection and looking more deeply at what our experience really is, until we do see its true nature, and then the images of tearing a veil or of some kind of insight or vision at that point. So that, in a nutshell, is the Buddha's teaching, put in terms of lying, and the alternative to lying. If we accept the premise for this discussion, which is human beings tend to lie to us, we tend to lie to ourselves about our lives. The alternative is not lying, yes, but for Buddhism, it goes rather deeper. The alternative is what Buddhists call wisdom. And so for me, as a Buddhist, that's really what the Buddha represents. And in this process that I went through over the last few years of writing my book on the Buddha, the question I was asking myself behind the whole business of trying to organise this very unwieldy material and to put it into readable prose was, well, who was this man? And what was this experience that he talks about and Buddhists talk about, which is enlightenment? And I think I might finish my talk there, which is what Buddhists usually do. We usually cop out of that. Because it has become quite difficult to talk about.
Shall I leave it there?
I think
that's
I'll
good. That's yes. Great. Thank you very much, Richard Pine. In a way, very, very nice to get a wee taste of the Buddha in such a concise way, and actually starting the dialogue in
yes.
terms of talking about what the Buddha was going on about experiencing teaching in terms of lying. So in a way, it is already starting that dialogue. But before we go on to the dialogue proper, we're going to hear from Dorothy. Now, by contrast, I've only just met Dorothy for the first time, but I have been aware of her. She's a very, very well-known figure. She was the head of psychology services in Lincolnshire quite a number of years ago. But she's also a very prolific writer. I don't know how many books you've written now.
I've written 16. Bertrand Russell wrote 84. He never learned how to make a cup of tea because he always had a woman to do it for him. If I didn't have to do housework, I'd have been more
important. Dorothy's a very prolific writer. And I was just reading that she was listed as one of the 100 most powerful women in Britain last year.
Only in politics.
Only in politics, but hey. There you go.
Which I will.
She's written a number of books. Most recent one, she's probably most famous, I think, for your work on depression. But actually, she's written about a whole lot of other things, in a way, extending your insights into a whole lot of different areas. and most recently this book called Why We Lie, which is a very fascinating and lucid account of that theme of why we lie, and in a way the ramifications for ourselves but also very much for the world. So it's really lovely to have you here, Dorothy, and
thank you
for what you're going to say.
Thank you. I'm a clinical psychologist and writer, and in my work as a clinical psychologist I've always been concerned with trying to work out why people do what they do. Well, that's been the problem for me all my life. I always had to work out why my family did what they did. And so that started when I was a small child, and still working on that issue. I've written quite a lot in different places about religion, because it comes up in all sorts of ways. So in write about in connection with depression, I'm often want to say the church keeps me in business. Keeps selling my book Depression the Way Out of Your Prison, for so many people get depressed. Why? Because they are good people who always worry about not being good enough. And where do you get that from? And where do you learn to be an expert in feeling guilty? That probably from your religious upbringing. One of the reasons I've always been fond of Buddhism is because it is a way of understanding life that doesn't put guilt at the centre of all. Not really born into a religious family, but my mother felt that she should make sure that she did the proper, right and proper things. So she sent me to Presbyterian church and Sunday school. She didn't go herself because she wouldn't stand her hear a man telling her what to do. But so I had to go off and I'd sit and listen, because there's not much else you can do when you're listening to a long sermon. And so I learned a lot about Christianity. I did make the effort several times in my teens to believe in God, but somehow I could never make myself believe in anything. That's the trouble. You either believe something or you don't believe something. You can't make yourself believe. In the same way as you can't make yourself feel any emotion. Because you have your own truths. Your own truth about what you believe, and your own truth about what you feel. But of course, lots of people make a lot of problems for themselves by telling themselves they believe something that they don't believe, or telling themselves that they feel something or don't feel something that actually they do believe, they do feel. They lie about their own truth to themselves and to other people. Now, all the religions have a certain core to them. You know, I'm sure most of you in this room know what the core beliefs of Christianity are. You know, you have to believe that Jesus was the Son of God and came to earth to save us from our sins. You have to believe in the Trinity, and that salvation is a matter of really good luck, because it doesn't matter how many good works you do, good works alone will not save you. It's whether God decides to save you or not. It's a pretty cruel religion. And it allows a lot of people to be cruel to others and to be cruel to themselves. But, you know, you could find this out, much to say about all the religions. And I'm not calling things a religion. And where it's not a religion is because it's the only set of beliefs that have been proved right by science. It's the only set of beliefs that's got a scientific support. Often in the over years when I've been giving a lecture about the kinds of things that I talk about, somebody afterwards within the audience will say to me, but that was Buddhism you were talking about. Some years ago, and I can't find this ever, I put it away in a very safe place, one of those places you never discover again. I got a very nice letter from someone in the Western Buddhist order who'd read an article I'd written for the Times about family values. And in that I put just a short paragraph, which I'm going to make it a bit longer than a paragraph when I talk about it to you. But it's just where I said about the way in which we make sense of the world. And this very nice man said in his letter that I was the first enlightened Westerner he'd ever come across. I thought, that's extraordinary. You know, well, I didn't have to do any hard work at all, except read some books and think about these things. So enlightenment is simple. But when I was reading your book, and when you were talking just now, yes, another conversation to have, I can see the only difference between us is in the language that we use.
Mm.
That's all. I've written a lot about the religions of the book, mainly about Christianity, because I know it so well. But I think it was back in 1982, I wrote a book which originally was called The Construction of Life and Death. It's now called The Courage to Live. Publishers like kind of upbeat title. When I started to work on The Construction of Life and Death, I happened to be in New York and through a friend met a philosopher at New York University, Jim Kass. And Jim had just written a book, or been published, called Death and Existence. And this book was Jim just systematically looked at each of the religions, and included Hinduism and Buddhism and that, and described how each of these ways of thinking dealt with death. And then when I was writing The Construction of Life and Death, I used what Jim had written to write my very short piece on Buddhism. And so if I read you this, but I wrote a long while ago, this is still how I would describe Buddhism. And where I'm talking about death. For the Buddhist, death is not an illusion, as it is in Hinduism, but a fiction. What we see is not reality, not an illusion screening reality, but the fictions we create in our attempt to find something permanent and solid in what is always flux. And the cravings we feel for our attachments are the cause of our suffering. When we give up our attachments to our fictions, cease to seek permanence in flux, and instead accept the flux, the becoming instead of the being, then we have found a liberation which is not a victory over death, that gives one more life, but instead a victory over the craving that originally made life painful and death fearsome. In the ultimate liberation, nirvana, a state of pure becoming, there is no being, simply an act without anything as an actor or object. Now, what I've said then, I can now repeat to you in terms of what science, what neuroscience has now shown about the way we operate as a human being. If you already know this, then you have a much greater command over your coping with your feelings, making decisions. Alas, this is something that we're not taught in school. There's a political reason for that. But this is something that we're not taught. You know, in our first 5 years, we learn an enormous amount of very complicated things. We try to describe to somebody what it is, what is the process of learning to read, or coming to understand how to add up. Very complicated. But when we're little, we can learn lots of complicated things, but nobody tells us about the way human beings operate. I think children know this right from the beginning, and then they're taught that their knowledge is wrong, that there is one way of seeing which is right, and if you think differently, you're wrong. And so most people grow up not understanding what they're doing every moment of their life. Of course, some people understood this. Buddha understood it. The ancient Greek philosopher Epictetus understood it. He said, it is not things in themselves that trouble us, but our opinions of things. Now, what has happened, let's say, during the Second World War, there was some psychologists started working for the Air Force in working on the real problem of how can a pilot see where to land his plane at night if he's only relying on two strips of light. And this is the whole question of the way our vision operates. And what these psychologists were finding was that we can't see what is around us. Our brain constructs things, constructs ideas. Our brain creates fiction. Now, and then the brain plays very clever tricks. Now, it seems to me, as I'm sitting here, I'm here, you're there, you're all over there, and there's the walls, and outside there is the world beyond. And it all seems very real to me. But that isn't what is actually happening. What's happening to me is that my brain, using my past experience of people, walls, windows, my brain has constructed a theory about where I am. And this theory, yes, fiction, is inside my head. And then my brain plays a very clever trick on me. It persuades me that instead of me being here, that instead of my picture of this room being inside my head, my brain persuades me that I'm in the middle and the picture is all around me. Now the same thing is happening to each of you. What you're experiencing as this room is a picture that's inside your head. And if we were able to take this picture out of our head and pin it up on the wall, and then we all walked round and looked at everybody's picture, we discover that no two pictures are the same. There'll be differences in structure. You know, when we're born, we don't open our eyes and see the world. We open our eyes and we start learning how to see the world. And what we learn depends on what sort of room we're in. Babies that are born in rectangular rooms, as I guess most of them, all of us were, learn to see the world in terms of parallel lines and right angles. That's why we have rooms this shape. Babies who aren't born into rectangular rooms, babies born into kraals in Africa, or in yurts in Mongolia, they learn to see the world quite differently. African farmers never bother to plough their fields in parallel straight line. But farmers in this country or this state, they ploughing has to be parallel, because that's the way they see the world. That's why we have all these rectangular buildings and not very many round ones. Only quite recently the architects have started designing round buildings here. But in Africa, you see the ancient buildings there, they're round. Or they're built on curves. Yeah. They're not imprisoned by rectangular shapes as we are. Now there is a vast amount of research that shows this. That we see the world in the way we've learnt to see it. We don't see the world as it is. And our brain has to guess, has constantly guessing to try to create the best guess. Now most of the time when you look at something, you don't know for sure, but your brain offers you a hypothesis that you accept. But you know those things are called visual illusions, where you look at something, there's the common one is the vase that's also two profiles. And you know how when you look at it, you see the vase and then you see the two profiles. And what's happening is your brain is struggling to arrive at a hypothesis for which there is good evidence to support it. That's how you live all the time. You don't know anything for certain. It is physically impossible for human beings to be absolutely certain of anything. And that's how we live all the time. What we have to do is to look at creating fictions that are as close as possible to what's actually going on. Like tonight, when you leave here, it'll be dark. I do hope that you are very, very good at creating a good guess about how fast the traffic is when you try to cross Holloway Road. Because if you're not good at it, there'll be an accident. And, of course, there are lots of times when we don't bother to find any evidence. You know, when we go off into a wonderful fantasy. The fantasy is very important. As long as we always remember it is fantasy and not tell ourselves that our fantasy is true. Unless, of course, you create a fantasy as a scientific same hypothesis, and then you put a lot of work into finding evidence to support your hypothesis. A lot of our projects start as a fantasy, and we work hard to find the evidence to support our fantasy, in which case then our fantasy turns into a truth. And that's what it is to be a human being. Now, I write about that all the time, and if you look at my books in chronological order, you'll find that this section of the book where I'm writing about how we make sense of the world gets longer and longer. And the reason is that my first book was published in 1978. And over that time, neuroscientists are finding more and more evidence to support the research that shows that we are incapable of seeing reality directly. Now, what the ideas that our brain creates out of our experience, some of those ideas become our sense of being a person. And I always use the metaphor of a whirlpool. You know, there's a stream going along and it reaches a spot where there are rocks. And the water starts to go round and round in a circle before some of it just then flies off and the stream goes on. And you know what, the way we talk about a whirlpool, if we came across a whirlpool in a stream, it's, oh look, there's a whirlpool, as if it was real. But if we reached down and tried to pick up the whirlpool, well, of course it would fall apart. What happens to us from birth, we start before birth, about 25 weeks gestation, limit, where our cortex is able to start creating ideas. Our brain is creating ideas from our experience. And I don't know when the whirlpool that becomes what you call I, me, myself, I don't know when that starts, but it's certainly early on. And what you like to think is a very fixed thing, it's there, it's me, is actually just a kind of whirlpool of ideas that can fall apart in a moment. And the reason that they can fall apart is that your ideas depend on being validated, perhaps by other people or by events. And as we all know in life, our ideas are constantly being invalidated. You know, your nearest and dearest, it's wonderful when they validate your ideas, but how often they don't. And you know the feeling, oh, it all falls apart. And I think everybody in this room is old enough to have had the experience and to remember it. The experience of discovering that some ideas that were tremendously important to you have fallen apart. You know, you've discovered that no amount of goodness prevents disaster, or the person you were going to spend the rest of your life with is no longer there. Or the job you were going to make your lifetime career is no longer available. and you know how you feel that you're falling apart. And when you, what you were reading of what the Buddha said, I can't say this for certain, but it makes me think of those times when we feel ourselves falling apart and we're terribly frightened and in a great deal of pain, and we're struggling to find some way of holding ourselves together when we're falling apart. And of course, that experience always precedes becoming depressed or becoming manic, and those experiences. And for us, for all of us, those are common experiences. If we understand what it is to be a human being and the way we experience reality, then when we feel ourselves falling apart, it's not very pleasant, but at least we know what's happening. And we can say to ourselves, well, something's happening that I know, you know, I'll just have to change my ideas. I don't know what ideas will work now. I've just got to go through a period of uncertainty until I put myself back together again. But if you don't know what it is to be a human being, then it means that you feel intense terror, and you feel that you're falling apart. And that is utterly terrible.
Great, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, sir. It's really, interesting. Well, again, a very clear description of this thing of what it is to be human and how it causes us trouble, or can cause us trouble.
Yeah.
So, discussion.
Yes.
Things that strike you, Bishop Parnie, listening to Dorothy.
Lots of things struck me. Religious beliefs have been proved right by science. That struck me. I don't know that I certainly wouldn't have the courage to sit here and say that. And there are some things like the Buddhist teachings about karma and rebirth, which certainly haven't been proved by science. So, fascinating. I think one thing that we could talk about, the interest to hear from you, is you've described how the self as a fiction, how we construct an idea of ourselves when really we're just this vortex, a whirlpool, and how when the ideas that give us a sense that whirlpool is something of substance are invalidated, then we have this sense of falling apart. From the Buddhist perspective, you know, that's one aspect of how we think about things, this kind of critique of ordinary life. And the other aspect is what we can do about it, which, you know, the Buddha talked about in terms of the path, and I said a little bit about that. And I'm just interested to hear maybe from you, what do we do with that knowledge? In your view, that knowledge that we are simply a whirlpool, and what do we do with it?
I'll describe. I'm no longer work as a therapist, but I've 18 years working in the health service, and I started off with a whole lot of ideas that I got from Freud, Freudian. And I found that while I didn't question the ideas, the thing was, it was that in the language you can't use that to talk to people. It's jargon there to create the impression that we Freudians or we therapists know things that nobody else knows. That's why psychiatrists and psychologists have their job, isn't it? To protect the prestige and mystery of our profession. So I simply started to listen to people and put them in the words they were using. And what I knew I needed to find out was how my client saw himself and his world. And what I was discovering was that because children aren't given this information early in their life, that no two people ever see anything in exactly the same way. After all, no two people ever have exactly the same experience. So, no two people ever see anything in exactly the same way. And the... So in trying to understand what the other person was telling me, what I was finding, invariably with my clients who were suffering all kinds of mental distress, was that they had grown up believing that the world is the way they saw it, and that they were the way they experienced it. They thought they were, or they'd been told they were. And these were fixities, and there was nothing they could do to change it. All they wanted me to do was to take away their pain, but they didn't want me to change them. And so we'd sit there and talk, and what I found myself doing, it was very simple, was when we, whatever story from their life that my client was telling me, or whatever issue we were discussing, my client would be presenting the way he saw it. And I'd say, I've had something like that. Now, I wasn't saying that my way of seeing things was right. It was just kind of comparing notes. We spent hours talking about our mothers. And I discovered that if I suggested to a client an alternative way of seeing your mother instead of being terrified of her, you could make a joke. This strange woman, you know what she does. Then that was an easier way of interpreting the mind. Now, my therapy sessions would go on for a long time, over weeks and weeks, months and months, until finally, my client, Penny, dropped. He realised that there were alternative ways of seeing things, and all he had to do was to choose which way he kind of fancied. And the moment, what I found was the moment the person grasped that idea, that he was free to choose to interpret anything in any way he wished. And that if he was sensible, he may as well choose interpretations that were easy to live with. Once he understood that, he had better things to do than come and talk to me. I was doing it in my office and being paid for it. But it's something that we can all do when somebody is talking to us. And it's all something that we do for ourselves. Why am I seeing this situation in this particular way? Why is it important to me to see it like this? That's a question that often is difficult to answer truthfully. Those are the ways in which once you've got that knowledge, you realise that you can change how you see things.
Mm.
That's the way
yes.
I see it.
Yes. It's interesting that the the method you're talking about there is communication, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's, you know, communication in a therapeutic context, but essentially it's that dialogue. I wonder if children, it's not going to be enough to tell a child, speaking as a father with a two-year-old boy, it's a bit early for this sort of thing, but it's not just a matter of telling people that. I suppose the question is, what is it that gets the penny to drop? That other people have an alternative reality, which requires the capacity to communicate and the capacity to listen.
But your two-year-old knows perfectly well that you have your ways of seeing things.
Yes.
His mother has her ways of seeing things, and he has his way of seeing things.
He certainly does know that.
Unfortunately,
yes.
His parents are in the business of telling him that his way of seeing things is wrong and silly and stupid and back, back, back. Or whatever you use.
I'm not going to answer that unless until I've spoken to my lawyer.
Contacting social services.
Yes.
The art of being a parent is finding. This is hard work. This is the hardest way ever to bring up children. But I'm sure a lot of you have done this and know it's hard work. Is that you show the child that you respect his point of view, or you understand he has his point of view, but in this particular occasion, my point of view is going to prevail. On another occasion, your point of view can prevail. And so you enter into a lifetime of negotiation, most of which you lose.
Funny you should mention that. My father's actually did you lose?
What do you think?
He's also a therapist, so every time I ask him a question, I got another question. If your father is a psychoanalyst, then you actually lose. Sorry, parent abandon.
Yeah, no, I wanted to just take up something there, because it seems to me what you're saying, Dorothy, is one of the things that can really help is starting to see that there's a plurality of points of view.
Yeah.
One of the things I was really struck by is in this image of the whirlpool, in a way it's a very particular recognition that I am a fiction in a sense, which is something we, of course, the one has in Buddhism.
Yes.
In terms of non-selfhood, but it seems to me that's quite a threatening thing to see, and I'm just sort of interested in a way your thoughts on that, and you know yours, Vishvapani, in terms of how that's approached from a Buddhist perspective.
Yes. I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, I think what do we do? We start by just noticing what the fundamental elements of our experience are, noticing what our feelings are, noticing what our thoughts are, noticing what our bodies are like. And in a way, that's the bedrock that you always come back to, and learning to pay attention and separate what you observe about your thoughts and feelings from your interpretation of that. So that's done through mindfulness practice, but it's also done, you know, actually sometimes more effectively through talking to other people. So I think it's in that process that one gets glimpses of the whirlpool. And any of these images that we use, including fiction and whirlpool, can sound abstract, but it's that experience of why do I act like that? Why can't I change in this aspect of my behaviour? How come I come to be in this situation again and again? Why can't I get on with that person? You know, how can I? Why do I get myself so stressed out at my work?
what is it that I'm doing? So when you ask that question, what am I doing? You see how you're creating your experience. Both in meditation, when you know the mind becomes very still, and you see how the mind just wants to keep thinking about things, for example. Why do I want to keep thinking about things? I'm just trying to be nice and quiet and peaceful. And that starts to show you that the emotional impulses that are drawing you to thinking about this or that or the other. And so I think for me as a Buddhist, and for the other Buddhists I know, it's that process of observing and unravelling, and also noticing the things that stop us really being able to observe. You mentioned Buddhism being a religion that isn't based on guilt, because guilt is one of the most unhelpful mental states that we can have if we really want to understand ourselves. If we're telling ourselves that there's something fundamentally wrong with our perceiving apparatus, you know, and with the way I am, who I am, then it's very hard to see yourself clearly. So, I mean, those are a few thoughts about how Buddhist practice. I mean, there are lots of other Buddhists in the room, so maybe we'll get some more comments later on.
With that experience of falling apart, and I spoke of it being so terrifying. What people describe when they're talking afterwards about the experience of falling apart, the fear is the feeling that they will shatter, crumble, disappear. That's what's so terrifying.
Yes.
That that's going to happen. And, of course, the ideas that have fallen apart have been invalidated. That's not everything. Not everything in the person, you know, the person doesn't forget how to speak or walk or doesn't forget what they've got to do that day. You know, it's only a few of, just a part of the person, their ideas that have fallen apart. You know, okay, you're not going to be the best footballer ever. You can't even play football. So that's an idea that falls apart, and you might feel that you're disappearing, but of course you don't. So that there's,
yeah.
And of course that it's this terror, because you know this is the reason people lie. We lie so we can avoid the feeling that our ideas are being invalidated. Why do we tell lies about ourselves? Because we don't want people to find out how inadequate we are. We don't want people to look down on us. We don't want to feel shamed in front of other people. So we lie to other people about ourselves. And of course we lie to ourselves about ourselves. Lies serve to hold us, to protect ourselves from that experience of falling apart.
Yes.
How do you think that compares to, you know, the Buddhist sort of motivation for, in a way, delusion?
Well, I suppose one context we can think about it is in that sort of moments of great crisis where and people have nervous breakdowns and become very, very depressed, and you know, the sort of pathology that goes along with that. But then there are these the Buddhism tends to put things slightly differently. It's the Buddha talks about old age, disease, and death as being the things which invalidate the whirlpool. You know, for example, so actually all of us, whether we are in that kind of crisis or facing some particular difficulty in our life, you know, it's intrinsic in the human condition that we get old, we get sick, and eventually we die. We all know that. We certainly know it intellectually. But And that is the most threatening thing of all. And that knowledge is there in how we think of ourselves, how we construct this sense of ourselves being a person. So how can we come to terms with that knowledge?
There's more things than old age.
Yes.
But the present state of we've got two leaders in two different countries, Ivory, Bengo and Gaddafi, who the reason they're hanging on to power is that they know that if they leave, they will fall apart, they'll become nothing. Mubarak is quite ill in his little palace at Sharm el-Sheikh. He's built his identity on being the saviour of Egypt, and now people have thrown him out. So, I would imagine the Buddha would have concentrated on the three things that for people then were so terrible.
Yeah.
But now we've got a lot more things that on which we build our identity and can lose.
Well, they're universal things, but I mean, in a way, actually, what you say puts me in mind of the great tragedies. Shakespeare is writing about king after king who's facing exactly what Mubarak is facing. Gaddafi is more or less like Macbeth, isn't he?
Yeah. The curious thing is that all literature, everything, plays and novels, poetry, is about that experience of having your ideas invalidated.
Absolutely,
and falling apart and perhaps recovering or not. And there it is, every play, every novel. But I'm the only psychologist that writes about it. I know analysts write about it all the time and talk about it. But when you say psychologist, no, it doesn't. No.
Mm.
And the reason is, it's so scary. Lots of people, including psychologists, don't want to talk about it. I don't know what psychiatrists do now, but I can tell you, psychiatrists I used to work with would run a mile before recognising what they feared most, that feeling of falling apart and disappearing.
Yeah, so I think a good point maybe to open up to questions from the audience. So,
just one quick one. The Dalai Lama talks a lot about how you can actually heal yourself, this idea of self, by helping other people around you, people, animals around you, etc. Have there been research that proves that helping other people around you actually sort of like regenerates your inner strength, etc.?
Yes, if you look up the website Positive Psychology, and you'll see it all there. Being good, being grateful, it's all there. There are no new ideas about human beings. They just get rehashed in different generations, presented in different ways. Yeah.
Just comment on that. Not being a scientist or psychologist and so on, but one of the things I do, talking a bit about mindfulness earlier, is teach mindfulness-based courses for cognitive therapy, for working with things like stress and depression, and Paramabandhu does a lot of that work. And in fact, maybe you can say something about this as well, because one of the areas that, there's quite a crossover between Buddhism and psychology in that. People finding this capacity to just become quiet and notice what's happening is very helpful in working with all of these conditions. And one of the debates that goes on, and where there's quite a lot of research going on, is it enough to just be mindful, or do these courses need to include some kind of compassion, some kind of element of kindness? And my understanding is that the research is showing that that is in fact helpful. Maybe Karabandi can say something about that. And that one of the approaches that I'm familiar with that does explore that, how to integrate compassion into that kind of more psychological based use of mindfulness is really the point is that our suffering tends to make us tends to isolate us. You know, some of the work I've done is with people with chronic pain, and when you're in chronic pain, that's an overwhelming experience, and you can't help feeling this is only happening to me. I'm separate from all these other people who are not in pain. And of course, the same is in many ways true. We think about our experiences of getting stressed, getting depressed. We feel separate from other people. And so the reflection can be that, in fact, our experience of suffering can be a point of connection with others. Because if we acknowledge this very strong experience I have, it's something that others share. Because at least as we know intellectually, it's a part of the experience of everyone, then my suffering can be a point of empathy and, in the end, compassion for other people. So that's my comment, but I know developing.
Just to add on that, I mean, so at least one study has been doing, looking at mindfulness approach for depression and looking at breaking down to see what actually, you know, when does it work for whom, as it were. And one of the studies has suggested that it's when people can develop a quality of kindness that it is actually successful. So it seems that in a way, is a sort of implicit quality in the mindfulness, that actually when people get hold of that, it makes a real difference. So, you know, in a way, it's not enough to just have a harsh superego looking at what's going on in here, but it actually has to be a kind awareness that makes a difference. And if that's really developed, then that will have an effect on, you know, that will tend towards leading to altruistic action. Mm. And certainly the course that I'm just running at the moment, developing and doing some research on, is very much focusing around kindness and actions that are based on kindness to reinforce that. Early days yet to see, you know, where that's going, but there just seem to be some sense of it being profitable. Yeah, go on.
Are you talking about kindness to yourself or kindness to others, or both?
Well, in both, because interestingly, I mean, again, for what the neuroscience, you might be better on this, Dorothy, but what the neuroscience that I've read about it suggests is, actually, whether you're being kind to yourself or kind to other people, it actually the same parts of the brain are being activated. And so from a certain point of view, you can access it from either end, either from the subjective, you know, being kind towards yourself or being kind towards other people. And I suppose I'd really go further than that to say that actually, if you can't really be kind to yourself if you're not being kind to other people, and vice versa, in a way the two things do go to some extent hand in hand to really, really do that. Yes.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your writing. It has been illuminating for me over the years. My question is, I'm a teacher at university, and a student came to me because I was working with him, developing his creativity. And he disclosed that he lived in a theory. And this theory was beautiful, but reality was difficult because it was a dream that he had to conjure. And I got into a conflict because on my Buddhist studies, I thought, well, actually that kind of makes sense. But on the other hand, as a teacher, I saw that he was in distress. So I advised him to go and talk to the school's psychologist. And he never went, and he never came back. Now he is functioning, I know he's getting on with his classes. But this was in the autumn, and I still don't know if I did the right thing. Did I validate or invalidate it?
A good thing.
It all depends on how good the psychologist was that he went to see.
But he never went.
But he didn't go to see. Sometimes just the suggestion that you might like to talk this over with a psychologist or a counsellor, because they've had more experience than I have, and at any rate, you know, I'm always pressed for time, and they could give you more time. Just that kind of suggestion can be enough to help the person think a bit differently about what the issue is. But when you stated to me, I wondered, was the problem, the theory is wonderful, but he couldn't produce, he couldn't be creative. He couldn't produce
the dream.
Yes, and that is terrible because I know a number of writers, and I know there are courses in lots of universities now on teaching creative writing, but I don't know what they do in them apart from teaching grammar. No, your grammar is really useful when you're writing because you can work out whether it should be a singular or plural verb. But you know, the ideas and finding a means of writing about them in an interesting way that will make people go on, that where that comes from. And there are a lot of people who study literature who find that while they can appreciate good writing, they can't do it themselves, and that can be a bitter blow to, because you know, our personal pride is involved in everything we do. But if he's gone on with his studies, nothing to worry about. And suggesting you go and talk to a therapist, that's so common nowadays, for that suggestion. Whereas, say, 20 years ago, they thought, oh, she must be gone.
But that was the situation, because I thought, actually, this is a really interesting discussion.
Yeah.
Yes, I could say, right, you experience the theory as more real. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
And in reality, he called the dream, and the reality was the dream which was difficult to endure. So it ended up actually being, for quite a few meetings, fascinating.
Well, if you're an introvert, I write a lot about introverts, extroverts. If you're an introvert, the external reality, that's what's right, you never take it for real anyhow. Why should you even take it for real? It's extroverts who believe that reality around them is, they experience it as being real and they never doubt it. So if you're an introvert and you say, I always doubt external reality, introverts look at you strangely. What's wrong with her? So,
I think, I mean, for me, in terms of Buddhist practice, the way that I think what I think I would say to someone in that situation is, yes, all we know is our experience, and we don't know if our experience of the world is maps onto reality beyond it or not. So we need to take our experience really seriously and learn how to look at our experience and learn to find those parts of our experience which are stable and which ground us. Because the idea, if someone's saying the world is a dream, that is not only a philosophical idea, that has a kind of emotional meaning as well. Dream means unreal, means unreliable, scary. So I think you need to come back to things that you can actually observe in quite a simple way.
And of course, the best writing comes from your own experience.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Out of your own lived experience.
Well, where else can it come from?
Yeah.
I've got a question about where, I suppose, trusting oneself comes into all of this. So that if you kind of, because I think it's an issue that, you know, I have, it's like, you know, what do I want in my life and what's right for me? And so if I see that, I don't know, I am a horrible person and reality is, you know, it's all a movable feast and not true, how do you trust yourself? How do you make decisions? How do you know what's right for you?
Well, perhaps that's why you become a Buddhist, because that is the question that Buddhism addresses, isn't it?
Well, I don't know a huge amount about Buddhism, but
no,
perhaps
it does. That is it. How can we live amongst such uncertainty if we insist that there's things stay the same, that reality is repeatable, we'll suffer. So not to suffer, you have to accept what seems to be the truth about existence, that everything is in flux. We can't be absolutely certain of everything, but we can be reasonably certain of quite a few things. So the art of living is to be able to live with uncertainty.
Yeah, you mentioned trust. I think that's really the heart of it. Trusting that, well, I suppose both Dorothy and I have been saying is that we import ideas about ourselves that are ways of saying that things are stable, things are controllable, we can control our lives in some way, in order to, because we don't trust the reality that we find ourselves in. So then you're asking, well, what happens if I take away those ideas that I am in control? And it is a matter of trust, and it's certainly when it's put as starkly as it's been put tonight, it's, you know, why on earth would anyone want to be a whirlpool in a vortex? But it's a matter of trusting. In Buddhism, it says that actually that's liberation. Letting go of those ideas is profoundly liberating. Then we can really experience, you know, who we are, what we believe, what our feelings are, what our thoughts are, and that these are conditioned, these are shifting. But that we can also exercise choice within that. We can guide the whirlpool, or whatever the metaphor might be. We can find, I was talking about the Buddha at the beginning, looking at the mind, seeing that it's a process, and realizing that he could guide that process in directions that would lead him, A, to be more in accordance with reality, and B, to be happier. But you can't know that in theory. That's why trust is important, but also experience.
Okay, we've got a question over there, and then one over here.
And one over there.
Yeah.
You said, Jonathan, that we start with our truth, that we have... it's kind of going back a step from the previous question. Are we born wired a particular way? Do we start to take our life? That sort of influences the way we see the world, or are we really a blank canvas? What would you say to that?
And as our brain develops, when your cortex gets to a certain stage around 4 to 5 weeks, then your brain is capable of the baby in the womb hears different sounds and is able to distinguish pleasant from unpleasant sound. The baby understands pleasant and unpleasant in all sorts of ways. So there you are, 25 weeks old, you can distinguish pain from pleasure, nice sounds from nasty ones. And your mother is happily married, gets along well with her partner, there's no problems, it's just a lovely household. So all around you are pleasant sounds and pleasant voices. On the other hand, you might be the baby in the womb of some young woman in Gaza or Benghazi at the moment. And what you hear are screams and shouts and bombs and guns. And sometimes your father gets angry with your mother and she cries. So right for me, different experiences. And that's what you, and that's, those are the feelings that you carry.
Things really like being an extrovert or an introvert.
That does seem
and
to have...
And where that comes from.
Oh, if you're all the different psychological theories that all have this observation about introverts and extroverts. Some theories talk about introversion and extroversion. And in some theories, they use different terms. Hysterical obsession and such, they're just picking up on certain facets. And this is a very marked distinction, and it seems to be something we're born with. But it depends what we do with it. And of course it depends with who we encounter. You know, if you're a bright extrovert baby wanting, as soon as you're born, to, oh wow, great world, I'm here to party, and your mother is depressed, you're not off to a great start. But if you're born to a wonderful extrovert mother who says, wow, I'll party with you, your life's quite different.
So there's a question over here, yeah.
Yes. Thank you, everybody, for a very rich discussion. I'm really enjoying it. I was very struck by the image that you used of a being as a whirlpool, because I come, as a therapist, from an oriental way of seeing energy. And when I'm teaching students about the way energy flows in the body, I use the same image to show them why it is that energy surfaces at certain places in the body. There is a whirlpool which can be accessed. And I'd just like to say that for me, there is a lot about the body-mind axis and how the one affects the other and how that can be used in therapy.
Yeah.
I was reflecting on something Vishwapani said earlier.
Yeah.
You were talking about the difference, therapeutic approaches, and whether empathy has an effect, empathy and compassion. And I think I had a question about that, because I thought all therapeutic approaches would start from empathy as the starting point, total empathy for
right.
the client. And so I wasn't sure where that question came from.
Okay, I'll just say, explain a little bit about what I was saying. I'm not a psychotherapist, but I teach mindfulness-based therapies. And some of them, and I certainly wasn't talking about what the trainer or therapist does. I'm sure that all therapists need to be empathic. And certainly I try to do that in my work. But there are different emphases in the way that these different courses work, and some of them focus on helping people become aware of themselves, which is, you know, mindfulness broadly speaking. You know, aware of your thoughts and feelings, able to observe your thoughts and feelings, and there often kindness is implicit, which is what Paramabandhan is talking about. It's an attitude of kindness. And then there are other approaches which are trying to direct one's attention, direct the attention of people doing the courses, to other people and relationships. And that's just a different approach that some people, different people take. So that's encouraging an attitude of empathy among the participants. Yes?
I was thinking about, you mentioned Mubarak and his falling apart. And I was thinking in terms of his construction of his world. And I was interested from a Buddhist point of view about how Buddhists construct their world as well.
Yes.
And how, well, we all construct our worlds and how rigid they can be. And something about if you had Mubarak or a member of the order who's got a very rigid sense of themselves built up over years, how would you work with them in a psychotherapeutic way or in a Buddhist way to help them get beyond that fixation of self?
I mean, that is something Buddhism talks about. Talking about the, this whirlpool and then the things that stop us from seeing that we're a whirlpool. And this Buddhism has this image of ten fetters. The first one is self-view, which is largely what we've been talking about tonight. We have this self-view, and that's a fetter. It locks you in. And every time I come to London, I talk about this sort of thing. I always think of Blake's poem in London, where he talks about mind-forged manacles. So the mind-forged manacle, the first mind-forged manacle is the manacle of self-view. The second one's doubt. And the third one, this third one is attachment to rites and rituals as ends in themselves. And that is the great danger of having a religion. That the things that we establish become rites and rituals as ends in themselves. Mm. What is the antidote to that? And I think I come back to the discipline, which is actually looking at your experience and seeing the effect of becoming attached to particular teachings, particular practices on yourself. The whole training from a Buddhist point of view is about sensitivity to one's inner experience. So the real antidote to attachment to rites and rituals is that kind of sensitivity to the fact that now I am creating a fetter for myself. I just wonder if Kamala Shiva, do you have any comments on that? Or no? How do we stop rites and rituals becoming a problem? I don't mean to put you on the spot if you don't have anything to say.
I haven't got anything to say.
That's fine.
There's a Buddhist saying on that, whatever I'm doing, consider the state of my mind.
Consider the state of my mind. Yeah. It's just a little aphorism. Maybe that'll do for me. I wonder if Dorothy has something to say.
Changing someone like Mubarak. A lot of people reach a point in their life where even to contemplate changing their ideas seems to them that would destroy them. And when often we don't realise that how many ideas we hold that we take to be absolutes. There are more people than Mubarak who believe that the great mass of humanity is incapable of looking after themselves, and what is needed is a strong man or woman to tell them what to do. And that would be one of Mubarak's ideas, I guess. But when a person gets to the point in their life where if they discovered that they had wasted their life and caused incalculable harm, then that person is more likely to avoid any experience that would even bring those ideas into their mind. So all I'm saying is that therapy cannot cure or change everybody. It's resistance. clients. I don't want to change their ideas. People have to hang on to certain ideas in order to hold the world build together.
Mm. Just as a writer, one of the things, I'm a member of the same order that these guys are, but one of the things I see is that people who have been practicing for a long time sometimes get very fixed around themselves and find the idea. So they're doing these practices that are undermining the sense of self, and they're rigidly hanging on to the sense of themselves, and so they seem stuck.
Perhaps if they understood what the process was, that they there's nothing to be frightened of discovery, that you don't have to hang on to rigid ideas. There are certain ideas you can think, I rather like those ideas, I'm not going to give them up at the moment. But there's nothing to be frightened about changing an idea or modifying. Now that's what a lot of people can't manage to do, because they get stuck. Mm.
And sometimes it does come back to what you're saying, that something happens in someone's life and they have a sense of falling apart. And that's how it happens. And you can't regulate that. You know, people just have to fall apart in the end, and that's the only way that their rigidity will shift.
I've had a lot of people being depressed say to me, depression was terrible, but I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I understand people that they didn't want to stay before, and they had fallen apart.
Okay, there's been a load of hands up, but we're actually running out of time, so I'm going to take two more for the one and hand up there.
The Indian lady at the back's had her hand up quite a long time.
Oh, there you go.
I was thinking a lot of ideas that you talked about and we use in therapy, Bajorian principles, for example, as well as the principle like underlying facility, as you were talking about the, you know, wanting to look at events in a certain way, and then looking at reality as we perceive it, or reality as it is. And it's also the challenge that we face about changing something in order to see it differently, as a change is difficult. But there is something about creating safety, and you know, in terms of Buddhist beliefs, it's also about creating a safe place within ourselves to be able to trust ourselves,
yes,
and to be able to listen to what's going on for me, and then from that place to be able to see what's going on outside. So the whole thing is, but it's somewhere also maintaining a sense of good enough self that can trust that if things change and as they are, to be able to remain flexible within ourselves, to be able to sustain the change, because when we are flexible, the change is actually less difficult than when we remain rigid and focused in one way. So, yeah, it's very interesting to hear.
That first comment, maybe we could have another person up there.
You've both talked about how it's healthy and helpful to accept that nothing's permanent, which you ought to experience it personally. And I suppose I'm interested in what happens up to the age of 21. I think neuroscientists at the moment believe that the brain is still developing until the age of 21. And if there are a number of traumas within those years, that the brain will not develop healthily and unhealthy emotions will ensue. So I suppose I'm wondering, is there any is there any work being done for humans from 0 to 21 who are going through trauma? I suppose what I'm trying to ask is, it sounds a bit glib, but you know, if young people were told to embrace the idea that nothing's permanent, trauma happens, would that help them? You know, is there a preventative element that can be brought in?
that when we talk about what neuroscientists do, neuroscientists are a huge group and they work in different ways and they're examining different hypotheses. When I talk about neuroscientists, I use that word because it just is able, it covers the people who study the how the brain develops, and it covers neuropsychologists who study things like how we create our visual or auditory perceptions, and then there are developmental psychologists who are looking at how a child's behaviour changes over time. What we was known by the end of the Second World War, certainly when Germany, Nazi Germany, could be possible to see what was happening there afterwards, it became very clear that a baby needed to bond with a mothering person. And the children who didn't have that experience were quite often very strange people, you know, not kind of human. They certainly lack the power of empathy. They don't understand that other people have feelings. If at that point psychiatrists and psychologists had said the most important thing for us to study is whether it is possible for a child to have experiences that overcome the disability of such an unfortunate beginning. But did they? No, they didn't. They went off and they measured people and they divided them into all these different mental disorders and all these kind of measuring intelligence and stuff. What a waste of time. We still don't know whether, what the capacity is for children to overcome trauma. And that problem has multiplied because since the Second World War, we've had endless conflict that involved children. But what little we do know is that some children, given, but I have to call the right kind of loving care, can learn to behave in a way to overcome the trauma. Certainly trauma, whatever age you are, affects your brain because everything we experience one way or another is laid down in our brain with changing patterns of neurons. But we know, we've got more evidence than we need, that not only does war and conflict create lifelong problems for a person, but they get passed down from one generation to another, because if you haven't been properly mothered, you don't know how to mother your children. And so on. So that the kinds of things that are happening now, say in the Middle East, they weren't resolved themselves by each of the countries there becoming a democracy because of all those generations of people who suffered trauma.
So, hard task, but you're saying that there is some possibility with the right kind of attention that things can be.
The number of children who get there is minute.
Yeah, sure.
The vast majority of children get nothing.
I want to make one last comment just before we wrap up.
Go for
it.
Yep.
Yeah, so no, it's not a comment so much directly on that, except that as a parent now, myself, that is, I feel I have a role within that in relation to my son. How can I give my son the conditions that will enable him to not only avoid traumas, but to become as healthy a person as possible. And then the next bit comes from my Buddhist practice, because it seems to me that the way that I will come to understand that is by understanding myself. understanding, so that, and then kind of broadening out in an attempt to sum up. The reflection that this evening's left me with is that question, how do I construct this sense of myself? Where is it helpful? Where is it fetter? Where is it at odds with what my experience is telling me? How do I, you know, what are my implicit views? What are the ideas that I tell myself that about who I am? I'm special. For what reasons? For these reasons. And I think it's something about understanding that in myself and freeing myself from those ideas about who I am and how life ought to be that will enable me to pass that on to the next generation. So, so there's a reflection to maybe just to finish from my point of view.
Great. Thank you very much for a very stimulating evening. I can see there's obviously a lot more questions. I'm sorry we couldn't go there, but in a way that does say something about what a lot of interest there was, and in a way a lot for us to go away and think about more. So maybe we just thank our two speakers.